Blog Talk Radio.
Coming up on the big show tonight from the new film Last House on the Left, actors Garrett Dillahunt and Ricky Lindholm. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United.
To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a movie. Only a movie. Only a movie. Only a movie. Only a movie.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, everybody, this Sunday evening. Hope everyone's doing well. The Movie Geeks are here, Jamie and Jerry, and I am Jamie.
And I am Jerry, and welcome to our wonderful show tonight.
That's right, The Wonderful World of Jamie and Jerry. That was the original title of the show, actually.
That really was. That we were really contemplating that.
Yeah. We're going to do it in little. We're going to do the show in little teacups. We're going to sit in The Wonderful World of Jamie and Jerry, like a Disney thing.
Yeah, like Disney thing, and then we're going to have the Back by Midnight special. But I love that show. He's doing a good job on there.
Yeah, of course, we're talking about Aaron, who is our home entertainment correspondent, and he was on our show for a while on a regular basis, and he started his own show called Back by Midnight. I can't believe I'm opening the show promoting someone else's, but let's do it anyway.
I know, really, dude. That's my fault. I feel like such a dumbass for doing that. I know Kitten Fist is going to have a field day with me after that, but...
Yes, but it's a good show. He spoke to William Friedkin last week, and that was a dynamic conversation.
Yeah, it was. Dynamic being the key word there.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I'm afraid of William Friedkin because I'm afraid he'll do something to me like he did with Aaron and just tell him flat out, you don't know what the hell you're talking about.
You know what I'm really afraid of?
Yeah.
I'm afraid he'll send me the like 6-hour version of Jade and make me watch it and then talk about it with him. That's what I'm really
that would
afraid
be
of.
That would be the worst punishment at all. We got a great show tonight, and I believe our first guest is on the line. So let's get right to it. We are thrilled to welcome back to the show one of our favorite actors. On television, he's enjoyed a string of recurring roles in some of our best series like The Book of Daniel, ER, Damages, The 4400, Deadwood, John from Cincinnati, and Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles. On the big screen, he's delivered incredible performances in powerhouse films like The Believer, No Country for Old Men, and The Assassination of Jesse James. He plays the murderous Krug in the new film, a reimagining of Wes Craven's classic, The Last House on the Left, which opens up on Friday, March 13th. Here's a little clip for you.
Is that your sports utility out there, Mary? We made the front page. That's what's going on. We figured they'd have my face on there sooner or later, but now they got Sadie to boot. Can you believe it, Paige? Mary?
We won't say anything to anybody.
Well, I don't know. Frank, you believe him?
You know, I think maybe I could.
Yeah, well, I don't. We swear that we won't tell any...
Paige.
Oh, my God. Please, just put the knife down. You can have my keys. I don't care. Just don't hurt her.
Thanks, Mary.
Okay, so can we please just go now?
I'm sorry, ladies. We just can't risk it.
Yeah. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to the show actor Garrett Dillahunt. Garrett, are you with us?
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Yes,
I can hear you. Great.
Welcome
great.
Back.
Oh, good. Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
I'm excited about this movie, man. But I was reading an interview with you, and of course the obvious question that most people are asking you and everyone else involved in the project, I'm sure, is whether or not you saw the original before signing up. And you said that it somehow passed you by, which was odd for you, because you're such a huge fan of 70s cinema.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, and we're paying tribute to the 70s. We just did a tribute to McCabe and Mrs. Miller last week.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, what were some of those films of that period that really struck you the most?
It's hard, and sometimes I didn't realize how certain films are from the 70s. You just, you know, like certain films. But I always list Badlands among my favorites. Yeah. I can watch that thing all day long, and I just never seem to get tired of it. I loved, like Electroglide in Blue.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Yes, I do.
I thought that was cool, and there's this great movie called Scarecrow that was early Al Pacino. And
that's a great film. Great film.
Hackman. There's so many. Yeah. I loved the Three Musketeers movies with Michael York.
Oh, those are wonderful films. Some of the greatest sword fights.
Fun. Yeah, exactly. One of the reasons I became an actor is because of those movies.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those movies. You mentioned Scarecrow. I've been trying to sell people on for years because it's a real gem of a movie that a lot of people don't know about. And one of the great pleasures for us, we spoke to Jerry Schatzberg, the director of that film, about Scarecrow and Panic in Needle Park, and I was in awe. He was probably slightly embarrassed. Yeah. We try. So Last House on the Left. So now it's time for the obvious question. You had not seen it, so when did you catch up with it? Right. After you read the script?
Well, I didn't want to watch it before shooting anything. So I watched it in bits and pieces after we were done shooting. Just to see. I think sometimes you can get improperly influenced by someone else's performance if you're playing the same part. I do the same thing when I'm on stage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people rush out and, you know, they get cast as, you know, Romeo or something. They'll rush out and rent the movies of Romeo and Juliet or go to Lincoln Center and watch tapes of past productions.
Mm-hmm.
I find it's an unnecessary obstacle because then instead of following your instincts, sometimes you're thinking, I want to do something different than that guy did there, so I won't do that. I'll try this, and I think it just gets in the way.
Yeah.
Even
so, you met with David Hess, who originated the role, didn't you?
I didn't meet with him. I don't know how that story got out either. I called him long after the fact. I did an interview before, and I wasn't misquoted, but I was mispunctuated.
Okay.
That
makes sense,
actually.
I think I said something like I said the phrase like, it's not like we're remaking The Godfather.
Yeah.
And it was in the midst of a whole conversation about my point was not so many people knew about it as knew about The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded in the interview like I was criticizing the quality. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I tracked him down and called him up just to assure him that I was not being disrespectful. Because I really like actors.
Yeah.
And he was really cool. He was really cool. We had a nice conversation then just about, you know, the process and, you know, a little bit about what he did and how foreign directors seem to really like us both.
Right.
He's a really nice guy. He's a really
nice
guy. I really enjoyed talking to him.
I'm wondering,
I hope he'll be at the premiere. Sorry.
When is your premiere?
Tuesday
night.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wow. Yeah. I'm wondering about your reaction when you read this script. First of all, do you follow the genre at all, the horror kind of thriller genre? Are you a fan of it in general?
I like all kinds of movies. Yeah, I think a hardcore fan would probably, you know, sniff at my sensibilities maybe or my knowledge of the genre. I like a good story. I don't care what genre it's in.
Right.
I know that there's a, it's almost like a subgenre of horror too, right? There's people that like sort of the exploitation side of horror.
Mm.
There's people that kind of like it if it's badly acted and badly produced, you know, that they like the feeling they get from that.
There's a lot of truth in that, yes.
Yeah, you know, so it's not, it's complicated, you know, but
That's a very nice euphemism for that, yes.
Yeah. Now, but did you have, what was your reaction? Because this is, at least the original film was very brutal, and I'm sure this
one
is brutal by necessity. I mean, that's the story you're dealing with. But what is your reaction to that kind of violence?
Well, I apologize if I repeat myself, because a lot of people are curious about how this came about, but I'll tell you how I got this part, because it's unusual for me. I don't get offers much, and I got a call about this movie. I guess director Dionysius, this is the story I got anyway, had seen Jeff James and wanted me to be in this movie. And I just assumed, they never said crew, they just said, want you to be in this movie. And I just assumed that they wanted me to, for, you know, the dad, for the doctor, Collingwood, you know. And because in the script, they kept describing Krug as the hulking Krug, you know, the massive, you know, dark silhouette in the back of the police car, Krug. And I was just like, oh, I might be tall and I'm reasonably fit, but no one's ever described me as hulking, you know. And I just thought, I'm probably the dad, you know. And he said, would you meet with us? And I came in for a meeting, and that's when they told me they wanted me for Krug. And I was a little bit surprised and sort of excited by that challenge.
Right.
But before I'd read the script, you know, they just sent it, and they sent along with it a copy of Dennis's first film called Hardcore, which I don't know if you've had a chance to see, but it's worth it. And my initial response was dismay, because I was just like, oh, geez. This guy did a film called Hardcore, you know, and you know how you sort of, you know, you're so hard on yourself, like, if they want me, this must suck, kind of, you know what I mean?
Right.
Well, after watching the Assassination, I don't think you should feel that way, or No Country for Old Men, you shouldn't feel that way anymore. If you did at one time, you shouldn't.
That's nice of you, but I don't know what it is. You carry your childhood with you, you know?
Oh, I do it every day, my friend, so don't worry about it.
It's therapeutic, this whole acting
thing.
But regardless, you know, I was like, oh, this must be crap if they want me. And then I read it, and I was like, this is actually kind of an interesting, you know, challenge. And then I watched his movie, which was so beautiful and handled so well, really delicate subject matter, including sex. It was uncomfortable when it was supposed to be uncomfortable. It wasn't shot in a way that I thought was, you know, him taking advantage of the situation. It was to further the story. And so I suddenly had a lot of faith in him to tell this particular story.
Yeah. And even so, it seems to be a little more fleshed out, this new film, in terms of the contrast between the two families, in a way. I mean... I mean, your group and the parents, the suffering parents, what did you find interesting in terms of development and character depth in this for you?
Well, I guess, I mean, in a way, you just sort of said the whole thing, you know, that is interesting. No, I mean, I don't mean that.
I tend to answer questions before I ask them.
Dude, I should just
Jamie
go.
Jamie is the amazing Kreskin.
Yes.
No, that's not what I meant, but I'm just like, that's the very thing that was interesting. You know, I like complex characters, you know, and again, this might be a difference between the kind of horror I want to see and the kind of horror that a lot of fans of the genre want to see, is that I get more scared about things that I feel could actually happen.
Yeah.
You know, like that, and I get a little charged out of that feeling of, you know, what would I do in this situation? And could I do it? You know, am I up to the task? And it's only more interesting then when, you know, you've got real people you're dealing with, you know, when you've got real situations. And people are complex, you know?
Yeah. Great actors.
He's a shitty father, but he's a father.
Great actors in this piece too that can really bring those complications to life. It's an amazing cast in this film.
I think so too, and we all, it was like everyone had something to prove or something, you know. When you say you wanted to elevate something, it's not always that there was a problem with it to begin with, but you know, it's like we were handed something good and we were all like, now let's contribute our part and try to make it even better. And the result is, oddly, this film that I'm quite proud of and I think is a little deeper than your average horror movie. I think there's plenty of exploitation there for those that like that or that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think there's something more there?
Yeah, if you want to look a little deeper, I think there kind of is. You know, it's not cut and dried. You know,
of course not cut and dry. I was just curious because of the times we live in now. Do you think with the whole, obviously the big thing of the original, from what I know, is the revenge factor. And do you think the revenge factor plays into a feeling that we felt after 9/11, this desire to strike out?
Absolutely. I think it's not necessarily specifically that.
No, of course not that, but that was just the first thing that came to mind when I saw the trailer.
No, I just mean not only that. I think the audience can kind of fill in the blank. I think a lot of people feel equally raped and powerless in the face of our own government, perhaps.
Oh, yeah.
Or the economic situation.
Oh,
or,
of course.
And certainly people could put terrorism in there, and what would happen if my home was invaded or my family was hurt. And
right. But it's the economic situation now takes the cake over that one.
You know, and it's a strange release. It's sort of, you know, we've put a face on that, you know, the cause of that powerlessness with, you know, Krug and his family for people. It's almost like, here you go, here's someone to hate.
Right.
You know.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
And, you know, we've talked about this before on the show. It's this genre of film is uniquely qualified to address those cultural issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like metaphor, right?
Yeah. Even so, I hear actors speak a lot about the importance of not judging their characters, and I'm wondering if that's a particular challenge for you when you're playing someone that does such awful things.
Well, I can certainly see how it is a challenge. You know, it's hard to say, you know, I played Hitler and, you know, I loved the guy, actually. I got to know Hitler. You know, he's not such a bad guy. And, you know, you can't totally separate yourself from your own morals. But you know what I think it is you have to want to tell the whole story more than you want to pass judgment on somebody. You know what I mean? And so it's like the way around it is. And while I certainly have sympathy for Krug, you know, I think, you know, life's certainly handed him a shit hand. But not necessarily any shittier than anyone else. I'm just swearing like crazy. Is that okay?
Go ahead. You're on the right network to do that.
Okay. Free reign.
Not necessarily shittier than, you know, anybody else in this world. Even, say, than the Collingwood family. They've been handed a shit hand, too. But they just have responded to that in completely opposite ways, you know.
Yeah.
Krug can't let go of it. He feels slighted. He's angry at the world. He's angry that he was born. You know, he's just, this is not, I've done everything right. You know, how can the pussies of the world live and I'm in jail, you know, and he's just, he's just so angry. You know, he's ill-equipped to deal with failure and hurdles.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I feel sorry for him, but at the same time, he's got to pay.
This is what fascinates me. This is what fascinates me about you playing this character, and maybe I'm wrong about you. It's just an impression I get about you. You seem, for lack of a better term, you seem like a pretty zen kind of guy, very very balanced. So I'm wondering for you how you get to the place where you're doing this pretty rough character.
Well, I guess, you know, I mean, you'll have to tell me next time we talk, you know, after you've seen it, if it was successful or not, you know, and I guess that we'll find that out when the film opens.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm sure it's successful. I mean, we love your work. We think you could do anything.
That's sweet of you. And I don't know what to say. You know, I don't want to demystify the whole thing too much, you know, or sound like I'm some, you know it all about. I feel like I'm still just figuring it out. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, I'm an actor. You know, I thought that's what we were supposed to do, was play people, you know, far-ranging characters, you know, widely divergent from one to the next. You know, that's what we were to aspire toward, and to play them fully and fairly and as much as we can without judgment, on all to serve the story, you know. And the story has to be told, You know, so.
Well, on the flip side of it.
That's freeing for me if we just think about telling the story. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that. But on the other side of that, there's how do you let it go when you're embroiled in such a intense character? Is it difficult? Is that a discipline that you're still learning? Or
well, if it's horrible stuff, it's a great joy to let it go. You just
mm-hmm.
like ah,
yeah.
You know, I didn't really do those things. You know, it requires a certain amount of focus, I suppose, on set. You know, which you know, depending on the day, you're more successful at than others, but. You know, this cast in particular was really a lot of really intelligent, funny people.
Yeah, that's what I understand,
And I think everybody was just, like, relieved as hell to, you know, blow off steam at the end of the day or, you know, play a practical joke between takes. And I think it was a self-defense mechanism,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. We spoke to Ricky, actually, and we're about to play her
yeah.
interview, and she said the same thing. She said the group was a lot of fun to be around.
yeah.
That was important. I'm wondering.
Excellent kisser, by the way.
I didn't cover that. See, we should have spoken to you first. I would have. I didn't investigate that with her, but
I told her I've been telling that in every interview. She's like, yeah.
I'm wondering for you as an actor. You do your homework. You come as prepared as you possibly can, and I doubt many of these film shoots allow for rehearsal time. Correct?
Rehearsal time is rare. I mean, beyond you know rehearsing just before you go.
Yeah.
And that's more for camera, you know,
right.
than you.
Right.
But this one we had a week of rehearsal before we started. Ricky probably told you.
Oh, okay. Because I'm curious, when you arrive on a film set, what that first day or that first week is like for you? And for this particular film, was there an aha moment where you thought, okay, I got it now?
I think, I don't know if there was. I remember in my research period, and I'm kind of in the middle with research. I do quite a bit, not as much as some, I think, and more than most. And it just kind of depends on the project, you know, what questions you have for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I had come across this FBI guy's, this profiler's chapter he'd written about Andrew Cunanan,
mm-hmm.
who's the guy
mm-hmm.
that killed Versace.
Right, okay.
Not where I was expecting to find inspiration for Krug, you know, because he had the whole, you know, issues with his sexuality and, you know, cross-dressing and just. But there was an account of a horrific murder that I didn't know he had done on his way across. Where he'd killed an older gentleman
mm.
in his house because he needed a new car. He needed a car.
That's right.
And there had been some other killings along the way as he needed things. But they were quite clean, almost merciful in their way, you know, if there's mm. such a thing. But this particular one was like just beyond cruel. Like just the amount of rage expressed in this murder was such overkill. I mean, he was
yeah.
like duct taped and burned and then stabbed and run over like multiple times. I mean, just this, you know, this guy was in his 70s or something, you know. And the profilers are guessing, you know, like, well, he was a tough old guy. He probably was not going to take any shit from this kid,
mm-hmm.
you know. He probably reminded him of his father. But they were just saying how this type of rage was rarely displayed outside of someone who knew the victim, you know, something personal. And he didn't know this guy from Adam.
Right.
And I thought Krug was like that all the time. You know, just there's so much rage. So I a long answer to your question, and I think that was for me the sort of there was a big click for me there.
Mm-hmm.
About how he behaves, how it's this twisted sense of fatherhood and leadership kind of come about.
Yeah. Have you seen this film yet with an audience? I know your premiere is Tuesday, but have there been preview screenings or anything? Oh wow.
Yeah, I've seen some screenings, and I guess. you know, it's still not a completely honest audience, if you will. I mean, it's either a lot of in-house people or it's press, you know.
Right.
And press has been really incredible to us, which, I mean, I was braced to have to defend it a little more, and I'm really surprised and pleased about how positive they've been about the whole thing. But I have seen it in front of an audience yet, but
yeah,
I've been nervous.
Can you do that? I mean, when it releases this upcoming weekend, will you try to sneak into the theater and see the audience reaction, or are you done with something after it's over?
This one is hard to sit through with people I know. You know, I'm almost thinking about just, you know, waiting in the lobby at the premiere, just because I'm so nervous about what people are feeling during it, you know, because you see them hiding their faces or just like, you know, they got their feet up on the chair, you know, it's really affecting emotionally.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to enjoy, you know, while I watch my friends go through pain and I think, you know, oof, maybe I shouldn't have invited them. So I would actually rather see it with a bunch of strangers and just see what an honest response would be, you know, either walking out in droves or they're cheering, I don't know.
I'm sure they'll be cheering. I think this closing of this film sounds pretty cathartic.
Yeah, that's a key word, I think.
Yeah. Your upcoming, I noticed one of your upcoming films is called Burning Bright. I wanted to ask you about that. You shot this in Florida. I think you shot this about 45 minutes away from where I am now.
Oh, really?
In Florida, yeah. I live between Tampa and Orlando, so I think you shot this near Orlando.
Yes.
Universal area?
Yeah, I think we stayed at the Hard Rock Hotel right there in Orlando.
Good times.
Nice. Yeah.
So tell me about this project.
This was, I didn't know much about it. I liked Carlos. He directed Quid Pro Quo, Carlos Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
And they called, it was one of those moments where, you know, I had like 3 days off from filming Terminator.
Right.
And they called and were like, would you do this movie? And I'm like, well, I have 3 days. And they're like, okay, we'll do it in 3 days. So they flew me out and I just kind of jumped in. So
wow.
I don't know how that one's going to be, but I really liked Breonna Evigan a lot. She's coming actually to the premiere with me on Tuesday. I mean, with a bunch of other friends.
Yeah, yeah.
She's pretty cool, but it's a twisted little storyline, isn't it? It's hard to tell people what that one's about.
I read I did read the synopsis, and I thought, I've never seen this movie before. I haven't even seen a version of this movie before. It's great.
It's the same people that did the, is it Little Children? No. What was the one with the girl from Juno?
Hard Candy?
Hard Candy, that's right, Hard Candy.
Wow.
The same producers as Hard Candy.
Wow.
So, you know, people with good pedigrees. And,
that's quite a film, yeah.
Yeah.
This one, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm just a bad father. Something about me says bad father. I'm a bad father in this one as well. A bad father with a tiger.
Right. And is there? I know you're an actor, and you'll pursue whatever your interests dictate. But is there a type of character or a type of project that you're longing for?
I don't know. I mean, we've talked before, so I feel like I'm repeating myself, but I like change. You know, that's what I get the biggest charge out of, is doing something different from last time.
Yeah.
Even if it's two bad guys in a row, it's like, well, these guys are different in this way. Or that.
Right.
You know, I just like that challenge. It might be fun to, you know, kiss a girl in the movie. And have her like being kissed, you know what
right.
I mean?
Yes. Yeah,
there's an acting challenge for her, whoever that may be, but
that
would be fun.
I wish you all the luck in the world on that.
Thank you. One geek to another.
Exactly.
Good luck with that, Sal.
We have our own problems with that here. Garrett, thank you so much, man. We are crazy about your work and can't wait to see Last House and anything else you come up with in the future.
Yeah.
Come back anytime, sir.
Yes. Well, thanks. You guys are sweethearts. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
Thank you, Garrett,
for being here.
Very much.
Bye-bye.
Good luck. Bye-bye. That is Garrett Dillahunt, a great actor. He's incredible. He's awesome.
He is. He really is.
I like him a lot. And Jerry, when did you first see Last House? Have you been aware of it for a while?
I saw the original, I guess, in 1987 on VHS. We watched it on a New Year's Eve. Very disturbing movie.
You watched it on a New Year's Eve? You rang in your New Year's with Last House on the Left?
Well, the year before I rang in with The Hills Have Eyes, okay? So.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, very disturbing. But those two movies, I think those two films are really the best that Wes Craven has ever been. I think that's his most effective.
Well, it seems that Last House, his version of Last House, is it's very primal.
That's the key word, yeah.
Uncensored in a way, unrestricted. Any kind of boundaries, creative boundaries that he would pose upon himself, he kind of pretty much shattered.
I'll probably learn more about that tomorrow night, because on a Horror Yearbook Radio tomorrow, we're going to have David Hess, one of the original, played, and we'll have him on tomorrow night. So that we'll just probably learn a whole bunch of stuff about the production of that film.
It's an interesting guy. And I was telling you earlier, you know this.
Yes.
He sang all the songs in Last House on the Left. And I think it's hysterical that Last House on the Left could turn out to be a big musical break for someone. But you have to ask about that, too. It's a fascinating movie. Look, we've talked to people that have done these films and probably not expected much from them. Maybe they thought they were in the midst of something special as they were doing it, but whether or not that'll catch on is a different story.
Right.
But they all of a sudden become kind of legendary status. And I think with Last House on the Left, it's one of those things where people refer to it and they say, "Oh, that movie." That's when you've reached a level of infamy.
That's true.
Yeah, and so they find themselves in this very unexpected legacy. That interests me, the path that these careers take. It is fascinating. I remember reading about Chainsaw, and they referred to it as that movie. There was the first time that the lead in that film, Gunnar Hansen, when he realized that the movie had reached that status.
Yeah.
He was looking at the house. He was years after the movie came out. And he was in Texas, and he happened to pull over, and he just got out of his car and looked at the house. And there were other people there. And one of the guys says, "That's where they shot that movie." He said, "Yeah, we've made it." we've hit it. Yeah, so let's get to our next interview, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Watchmen. Jerry, you checked that out this weekend.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And I was going to check out Last House on the Left. I was awaiting a screening here in my area, which are few and far between and hard to come by. But so it was unavailable for screening in my area. But you know, we will both check it out next weekend.
Yeah, next weekend definitely. Yeah, and we'll talk about it next Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get to our next guest. Her name is Ricky Lindholm. Just a charming girl, woman. I'm sorry, girl. What am I saying? Her television credits include Gilmore Girls, Pushing Daisies, Criminal Minds, and Scrubs. And you can enjoy her in films like Million Dollar Baby, Changeling, Pulse, My Best Friend's Girl, and the upcoming Powder Blue. That's the Jessica Biel movie. I think that's on the DVD in May, I think. A lot of guys interested in that one. She plays Garrett's cohort, Sadie, in the new Last House on the Left. And this is interesting. You guys need to look her up. Her videos are all over YouTube. She duets with fellow actress Kate Micucci, I hope I pronounced that correctly, in a terrific group called Garfunkel and Oates.
That's cool.
Isn't that classic?
Yeah, it is.
Great. And they really have great, entertaining, funny stuff. You can read more information about her group at garfunkelandoates.com. You can find her videos on YouTube. It's great fun. We opened up our conversation with Ricky by discussing her initial exposure to Wes Craven's original film.
You know, I watched it. I actually watched it after my first audition, I believe, for the film. I actually didn't even know it was a remake until then. I didn't know anything about it. I'd never heard of it. And then I rented it and was like, Oh, my goodness. Wow, this is amazing. No, actually, I didn't rent it. I called my friend who's a horror buff, and I asked him about it, and he's like, of course I have it, and he told me all about it. So,
tell me that reaction. You had already read, had you read the entire script or just pieces of your part?
No, I'd read the whole script, yeah.
Okay, so you kind of knew what you were in for with the project. What were your initial reactions when you read it?
Well, when I read the script, I thought it was the best horror script I'd ever read. Because I've auditioned for a lot of horror movies, varying degrees of, gore and, just different kinds of things. But there was never one that I was like, this is so captivating. And I also loved that there was a female villain.
Uh-huh.
So that in particular sort of appealed to me because I'd never seen that.
Yeah. So you said that it captivated you. And this is a bit different from your standard kind of horror genre film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm wondering, in comparison to that original, does it still kind of maintain that same sense of brutality and kind of violation in a way?
I think it does. I think it does it in a different way. I don't know which one is more effective. I think that's going to be up to the viewer to decide. But I don't know that it's as brutal necessarily, but I think in our film it's more personal because there's more time getting to know the girls. And, in the first one, the women are, immediately topless and doing drugs and sort of bad girls and whatever. And
right.
I think in this one, they're more innocent.
Uh-huh.
And maybe, even though you completely sympathize with the girls in the first one, I think you probably sympathize even more in this one. So I think that makes it more brutal in some ways.
Yeah. Tell me about the conception of Sadie and what excited you about playing her.
Well, like I said, I'd never seen a female villain in a horror script that I'd read. I mean, I'd seen it in a movie, like in the original, but I'd even gotten the chance to go in on it. Everything I'd gone in on or auditioned for before was, screaming, crying, blonde girl running through the woods, which is, that's kind of fun, but not like this, And I read this and was like, wow, she is just as bad as the guys. She is right up there with them. She doesn't apologize for herself. She's dirty and nasty and right in there with them. And I thought that was really fascinating and juicy and what a fun side of yourself to explore, I don't know if fun's the right word, but,
well, it can be liberating, I would think.
Yeah, completely. It's a part that you're not allowed to usually tap into.
Yeah. So was there? I know that actors a lot of times they build a backstory. Was that implicit in the script, or was that something that you did on your own, or didn't even?
No, I think. I think it was a combination of me on my own, watching the first one and speaking with the director and the writer, and everyone involved in creating it, helped me create a backstory for it. Although in some ways, once I started shooting, I think that her backstory is unimportant.
Yeah.
I think it was sort of important in building the character. And then I was like,
sure.
But then I realized one of the creepiest things about The Last House on the Left is they don't really give a reason why these people do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just, because most horror movies, I feel like they give a reason, they were abused, they had a mean mom, they had something happen to them when they were a child, and this, not so much. And I was like, oh, that's sort of the genius of the original, is they just kind of do it. And so once we started shooting, I sort of, threw all that away, and
when,
just tried
when you're...
to, have no motivation for it.
Yeah. I agree with you. When you're shooting a movie like this that is so completely intense, what kind of set is that? I mean, do you have to maintain kind of a light set to offset all that terrible stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they did a great job in casting, real actors. Have you seen the movie yet?
I haven't. I'm seeing it later this week, I believe.
Oh, great. I think you'll agree when you see it. Everyone in the movie's really holding their own. They really put a lot into it emotionally and physically, and it's just they started by hiring a really talented group of actors and a really great director who knew how to make the atmosphere safe for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
He was very respectful of the actors, and he sort of set that tone, and it made it easy for us to explore, like, while we were working. And so I think as soon as the workday was over, then it was lightness again. Because, you know, for the first month, it was sort of the three bad guys and the three good guys, except for the parents. It was just six of us. And we would, you know, sort of stay all in, like, the same little hotel every night, and we would have dinner together, and, you know, we'd sort of do our thing all day, and everyone would be focused. And I don't think it was a particularly light set when we were filming, but then as soon as the day ended, we would all go sit down, have a glass of wine, and just not talk about it, and just go, wow, that was interesting. So what about that rugby match, you know, and just try to be people again, I think, and then just go to bed. That was kind of a way to sort of reset every day, I think. Mm.
You are working with great actors here.
Oh, I know.
You mentioned Garrett, Tony Goldwyn, and there's so many great talents in this. Observing them, and you've worked with some great people throughout your career. Observing them, what lessons have you picked up? What have you learned from this project in particular?
Well, it was actually, it's interesting because everyone on this movie had such a different process. And I was like, wow, this is so interesting being able to watch, you know, because someone like Garrett, it's almost effortless because he's just, you know, he's just so skilled and he's been doing it for so long and theater and everything that it feels like he just glides into the creepiness just so smoothly and then just glides right out of it. And then, someone like Martha is, you know, very intense in her preparation and takes like that, all that alone time and really gets there and stays in that emotion all day. And, so it's interesting watching how everybody works. And, I think we all just sort of brought our own process to it. I'm trying to think of what I learned in particular. I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know what? I think I got a lesson in commitment. Everyone on this movie was really, really committed. Like, everybody showed up and threw down. Everyone's like, this is what I got. Take it, you know? Every single person, toe-to-toe. And also, everybody was really generous, which you know, sometimes, like, it's not always like that. Everybody, you know, because a lot of our scenes had six people, five people, you know? And so there was nobody who was sort of trying to step on anyone else.
Yeah.
It was a real company.
You talked about process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a process that you use each time out, or is each project different?
I think each project is different. I think I've been fortunate enough to play all sorts of different characters in different formats, you know, that I don't think it would even be possible to use the same process. I mean, the last part I did a guest star of, like, a nutty science freak on The Big Bang Theory, you know? So, you know, those two things have nothing in common. So I feel like with each part, it's sort of like, and, you know, I still feel like I'm new to this, so with each part, it's, you know, starting from the beginning.
Yeah.
And, you know, starting with the script, asking myself a lot of questions, and, you know, just trying my best to have something when they say action, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of starting from the beginning, when did you know you wanted to be an actress? What were the inspirations for you in the acting world?
I know this sounds right, but I think I always knew. When I was little, you know, I always wanted to be on Star Search, and I wanted to do pageants and things, but I always lived in a small town. So I never did that kind of thing. But I think it really fully solidified when I was in college. I was actually in film school, and I ended up spending a lot more time being in people's movies than making my own. And I just, you know, just sort of, my interest sort of went that way. And then after school ended, I was like, I really want to be on the other side of the camera.
And the auditioning process, and you talked about the audition for this one. Obviously, young actors, they audition quite a lot.
Yes.
Does that get easier for you as the years go by?
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I had one yesterday that was particularly brutal. I had a sitcom audition, and it was a room full of people, and nobody laughed one time the entire time I was in there. So one of those, not so easy. But in
yeah.
general, you know, but that just happens every once in a while, you know. Sometimes it just doesn't connect, you know, and everybody has that. I'm sure even Garrett has that, where, like, sometimes, you know, it's just not
yeah.
the thing. And so, but I feel like... you know, you do anything enough times, it gets easier.
Mm-hmm.
And you also, you know, the longer I've been here, the more I've been able to put things in perspective. Like, you know, so I didn't get this. Well, there's another thing always around the corner. There's always
right.
another part. There's always, you know, something right around the corner that could possibly be there. And if you don't get something, that might mean that something better is waiting for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're around long enough and you see it happen enough times where, you know, you can relax a little. And not put as much, you know, on every single audition. I feel like that's how it's gotten easier.
Maybe I'm mistaken, but the audition process to me, it doesn't seem conducive to showing what you, everything that you have, the best of you. I mean,
yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it's like, but the problem is, what's the alternative?
Yeah.
You know,
I know there's some directors.
Yeah.
Some directors just prefer to get to know or to have a conversation with the talent. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and I
yeah.
think that's effective to a certain degree. And I know Dennis did that before he cast me. We sat down for quite a while and talked
yeah.
about, you know, we talked about the character and our ideas for her and everything. And then we talked about, you know, dreams we'd had or, you know, just anything. We just talked and...
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him just sort of, like, looking at me. You know, I saw him sort of picturing me in the part or not, you know. And by the end of it, I think that's when he knew. And so I think it was a combination. But I feel like, you know, you just got to do it. You have to see
yeah.
them. You have to see what they would do with the role. Even though it is a pretty artificial process, in a way, so is making a movie. I mean, there's 40 crew people. There's a boom, like... 6 inches above your head. There's a makeup person, you know, squirting fake blood on you. It's, you know, it's you know, I think as close as you can get
mm-hmm.
to being on a set. You know, you have to block out all the elements and pretend you're doing the scene, you know.
I got to ask you about one of your credits and collaborations
mm-hmm.
in Million Dollar Baby.
Yes.
That had to have been a really special experience for you.
Oh my goodness. Oh my god. Like, I just, it was one of those things where I was like, is this really my life? And the funny thing is I didn't tell anyone that I got it because I it just didn't feel real and I didn't want it to go away. So I just,
yeah.
I didn't even tell anyone. I was, you know, at that point I didn't have an agent. This was my first movie. And Clint Eastwood saw me in a play and that's how it started.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was, yeah, I mean, in a little 99-seat theater in Los Angeles. I mean, it's just, it's absurd, almost. And then his casting director saw me in the same play when the play went to New York. And I think those two factors sort of came together in my favor. And it was just a magical experience. And, you know, my first movie won the Oscar. It's pretty, you know, not too many people can say that, I think.
That's pretty remarkable. Were you ever able to kind of separate? Because it seems like Mr. Eastwood is so kind of down to earth and approachable, in spite of what he's accomplished in his life. So,
yeah.
Were you ever able to separate kind of the legend from the actual man?
I think the first time I worked with him, no. But then when I did Changeling, I spent a lot more time on the set, and so I think
mm-hmm.
so. Yeah, I think a little bit. I mean, not completely. Because he's like, it's like he's Clint Eastwood, you know. It's like, I think he's probably one of the hardest people to completely, you know, divorce that, you know,
yeah.
idea
yeah.
of him. Especially because it's such a, you know, a positive idea of him that you don't even
mm-hmm.
want to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know what I mean? There's not like all this negative baggage that comes with him. It's just like all these, you know, wonderful movies he's made, and you know, all the things people think about him are pretty much true. So.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
it's almost like
he's,
a good thing to have. But I think he's one of those people, you know, he's been in the industry so long that he chooses his cast. You know, it's not other people casting it. So if he casts you, I think you feel comfortable because you know it was him that chose you out of you know, a lot of people. And so you feel like, okay, I can do this. If he says I can do it, then I can do it. You know, I'm not going to argue.
And really the most, from what I've heard from actors that have worked with him, like the most stress-free sets ever.
Yeah.
His approach.
Yeah. I mean, it's really remarkable. Like, the days aren't long. It's usually just one take. He doesn't say start or he doesn't, what is it called, action or cut. It's just, it's very quiet. It's very intimate. You know, it's just, it's really different than the sort of chaotic nature of some other sets.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about Garfunkel and Oates. I just saw it. I was listening to quite a bit of it. I love music. I love
really?
It.
Really? Oh, that's so
yes.
cool. Thank you. Yeah, it's me and an actress friend of mine, Kate McCucci. We started writing songs about a year ago and then really performing out maybe 5 months ago. And it's just been so fun. And we're just grateful that people actually like it. It's just kind of amazing. And we have the time of our lives playing out. And, you know, we had a song on Scrubs, which was, like, so exciting. And, you know, they sang it as a musical number on Scrubs, which was,
amazing. Oh, it's great. It's both of you sing very well, and it's so funny, too, a lot of the numbers that I heard. It's great stuff.
Oh, thank you. We're actually writing. We're going to make a new video tomorrow, actually. Called Pregnant
Great.
Women Are Smug. I mean, we're just kidding, but I mean, kind of kidding, you know.
No, it's all true. It's all true.
It's been like this fun outlet, you know, because every time I go on a bad date or something or have a bad audition or something, we can like write a song about it. You know, and we do.
Oh, that's
I just wrote a song last week called My Self-Esteem Is Not Low Enough to Date You. About this guy who's just kind of a jerk, and I'm like, no, you know what? You're not nice enough. It's just not going to happen, you know.
Oh, wow. But do you guys have a website or something that we can post?
Yeah, we do. GarfunkelandOates.com.
Okay.
Finally got it up. It took us a while.
I saw your YouTube channel, and I was looking at all the videos in your YouTube channel, and got very excited about it. I thought it was great.
Oh, thank you. I like, can't believe how many people watch it.
It's very popular.
It's crazy, right? I don't know how people find out about stuff. I don't know. I guess people just email it to each other. I don't know, but it's really exciting, and we just think it's flattering and cool that anybody likes it. And so, yeah, all our music's free on our website. You can just download it.
Oh, wow.
Go
well,
right
we'll,
to your iTunes, yeah.
We'll push that, too, on the show on the 8th.
Oh, thank
you. So how are you feeling now? I mean, your film opens on the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a couple of weeks away. Are the nerves going? Are you nervous or excited?
Yeah, I think it's weird. You know, I still talk to everyone in the cast all the time, which is really unusual, I think. I feel like you do a job and it's great and you get along and then it sort of ends there. It's like summer camp where you know, you go back to your life. And in this case, we talk all the time, and I was on the phone with Garrett the other day and we were just like, oh, we're so nervous. Like, we hope people like it. We hope people see it. Because I think we all think it's a really special project. And I think we've all just sort of invested in it, like, emotionally and mentally, and we just really want people to see it.
Do you go into the theater? Are you going to do that opening weekend and see the audience reaction for yourself?
I don't know. I don't know. I honestly haven't thought about it. I bet we will, yeah. Because, you know, you want to see that.
Scary films are the just the absolute best to see in a crowd.
Oh, my gosh. Wait till you see... well, maybe spoiler. Well, you'll see. There's a certain death scene, not mine.
I know what you're talking about. I know what
you
do. I won't give it away, but yeah.
It's so amazing. When I saw the movie, everybody was freaking out, and then like they burst into applause, and then like laughter. Like, it was so crazy that people started laughing.
It's
they didn't
a release.
Know what to do.
Yeah.
There's like you know, it's so crazy.
Oh, that's great. So what's upcoming for you?
Well, you know, just that, really. You know, I sort of worked a lot last year, but everything just out, you know. I have a couple movies that I did that aren't out yet, but I don't know when they're coming out.
Okay.
I was in a movie called Powder Blue with Forest Whitaker and Jessica Biel, and I don't know when that's coming out. And then I did this movie called Say Hello to Stan Talmadge with Jennifer Coolidge and Gary Cole, and I don't know when that's coming out either. So.
Okay.
So right now it's just this, you know.
I think they both say sometime this year. I did see the Powder Blue trailer, so I'm sure that's going to be right around the corner.
Yeah, I know. I bet a lot of boys are going to want to see that. I mean, it's like Jessica Biel and like a song and Angel Wings and nothing else. I mean, I don't actually know anyone who wouldn't want to see that.
I saw the trailer several times. So
I'm
excited. and I'm excited about Last House on the Left. I can't wait to see it. And I wish you the very best of luck. And please stay in touch with us and come back on the show anytime you'd like.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, thank you so much for promoting it.
Thank you, Ricky. I appreciate your time.
Cool. All right. Well, have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, Ricky Lindholm and Garrett Dillahunt. The movie is Last House on the Left. It opens Friday the 13th. That's this coming Friday.
That was really cool. I know, I enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun. That was really cool. That was good.
Yeah, so we'll talk about this weekend a little bit. You saw Watchmen and had the biggest opening of, I don't know, all the records are broke, but certainly the biggest opening this year.
Is it all the records are broke? I really honestly don't know, because they're saying someone was predicting $64 million and $70 million, and it looks like, what is it, $55.6 million.
Yeah.
You know,
the biggest opening this year.
Yeah, well, true. I mean, you know, anything would have been. I mean, it's bigger than Paul Blart.
This is a good year.
Dude, this is an incredible year. I mean, you couldn't. And actually, this is the first thing in a couple, like in a month, that I've really wanted to see in the theater. And it's a very interesting film. I know you didn't get a chance to check it out, but how do you want to do this? Because I don't, you know, because this is it. I don't know how this film plays with people, because if you hadn't read the graphic novel, I don't think you'd be interested. But from what I'm hearing from some people who took friends that had never read it, they were absolutely enthralled with the film.
Right. I like it how you said, how do you want to do this? Like it's espionage or something.
Well, it is, because here's the thing. The film doesn't, you get through it. I went to a midnight screening. You get through it, and you're like, okay, this is interesting. I've never seen anything quite like this. I mean, I've never seen a film, even more so than the first Harry Potter film, we talked about this last time, that the director is so loyal to the source material.
Right.
Now, I know there's these discrepancies in the end, and I don't want to go into that because that's massive spoilers, but I'll be very honest, this director took each panel of the graphic novel and brought it to life. And that's a good thing, I think, for the most part. I guess you don't need to do storyboards, I'm not really sure. Because you have the book right there, so why bother?
Right.
But and this Zack Snyder is obviously the person you want to do this, because he did the same thing with 300. Things that stick out that I think really work. There's a great opening, the credit sequence with Bob Dylan. The times are changing with the events of this alternative Cold War America, with these masked superheroes, and just the events that have gone on up to the present, which would be 1985. Richard Nixon is now president, I think, for 5 terms. We've won the Vietnam War. So in that sense, it's like a neoconservative wet dream. In that way, it's very fascinating. But I think the opening credit sequence is fascinating. I think it's one of the best sequences I've seen this year. And in many ways, it's a lot like what he did with the remake of Dawn of the Dead, with Johnny Cash's The Man Comes Around.
Right, right.
And this guy has a thing with music. I mean, it's not just the Bob Dylan song. There are a couple sequences with great rock music, and he knows how to use it. I think some of the performances are excellent. Patrick Wilson, Jackie Earle Haley as Rorschach, probably the heart and soul of the film. I'm not sure where I stand about Billy Crudup's Dr. Manhattan. I mean, they could have put some pants on the guy.
Right.
They really could have. I mean, it's just really disconcerting that, you know, it's all hanging out there. But
well, maybe they weren't expecting somebody like you to be staring at this package all
the time. Well, it wasn't just me. I think there were several people who just burst out. I just couldn't keep a straight face after all. I was like, hey, man, put some pants on this guy. I mean, no. But you want to know the truth? It's actually a really good movie.
Yeah.
I actually think it's worth the price of admission. I think it's worthwhile checking out a couple times. I would like to see it again. I would like to actually go check it out on IMAX. But I actually think, after all is said and done, it's a good movie.
Okay. Yeah, the that's what I hear consistently, that that opening 20 minutes is pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then it runs another 2 hours and 25 minutes.
Well, here's the thing. It doesn't hit you at once. There are problems with the film. I actually think after that credit sequence, the hour after that,
right,
is you really have to be into it. If you didn't read the novel, I think you would be lost. You would be like, what's going on here? The second half, though, there is a sequence, I guess we'll call it the prison break sequence.
Right.
That's incredible. I mean, just absolutely incredible.
So is Zack Snyder the next kind of, is he Michael Bay with more computer effects? What is he?
No, I actually think, he's shown that he's good at adapting other people's work. Let's face it, all three films are adaptations. Even The Dawn of the Dead is a remake, essentially. So I would like to see him do something original. That's going to be the true test. We know he can do other people's work and be incredibly loyal to it. But and that's a problem, I think. That's something you could make an argument. Imagine if Coppola had shot The Godfather the way it was written.
Right.
We wouldn't be talking about The Godfather.
Yeah.
We really would not be talking about it. So, it's not like there can be a sequel to this film.
But there was no preconception that the novel of Godfather was anything more than pulp, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's what Coppola did with it. He made it the focus
right.
of family. Now,
whereas Watchmen is majorly revered.
I think if the film has a weakness, its greatest weakness is that, you know, I wouldn't have minded, like, he took liberties with the ending. I wouldn't have minded if he did that throughout. I know that, you know, this is a double-edged sword. When you make movies and the fanboys are the main audience that you're courting, that you're going to alienate some people. And I think, judging from the reaction I've read from people who aren't, like, fans of the novel, they're like, huh? You know, what? You know, so I can see that. But it does, the film stays with you. It's much better than I thought it would be, because I was not expecting something as good as this was. I don't think The Dark Knight is the film you compare it to. And The Dark Knight is just, like, light years ahead of this.
What do you think you compare it to? Mystery Men?
No. I compare it to Southland Tales. They're both obsessed with the end of the world, the anxiety of the end of the world. I actually like Southland Tales better. But I think they're both obsessed with, there's this anxiety about doomsday and everything, and I think that's the first film I thought of, really. I didn't think of The Dark Knight. I mean, there's no Zack Snyder, Chris Nolan, night and day,
mm-hmm.
I think, personally.
Mm. So, do we have more comic book movies coming out? I mean, I know this wasn't like your typical comic book, but I know we have G.I. Joe.
We got G.I. Joe, and we have Wolverine.
Right.
We have Wolverine. I'm trying to think what else. Those are the two I know of right now. I'm sure there are more, but those are the two I know of offhand.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I only hope that they're as loyal to G.I. Joe as they were for Watchmen.
Well, we'll see. I think the big test they're waiting for is to see how it does next weekend.
Yeah.
That's really the true test of Watchmen's strength, how it holds up. And it has two big competitors, the movie we're talking about tonight, but also Race to Witch Mountain, which is a huge...
Disney family.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a family film. That's a huge competition as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Well, Watchmen accounted for more than 50% of what audiences saw this weekend. The others, you know... Out of the others, there's been a couple of steep drops, none more so than the Jonas Brothers movie. I think they're, 12-year-old fans went to see that last weekend. And,
yeah, I was surprised that didn't take off the way they thought it would.
I think you gotta like the Jonas Brothers. I mean, I think, to want to go see that movie. I mean, why else would you see that movie? And Slumdog obviously is doing well. It crossed 125 million this weekend.
Right.
The one that's surprising somehow is Taken. People are very taken by Taken.
No, but Taken is a superb film. I love it. I think it's very good, and it's the only thing out there. The only other competition that it really had was the international, and that just didn't even come close. That was muddled. It never really took off. Despite the Guggenheim Museum shootout sequence, which is brilliant, the movie never comes alive otherwise than that. It's just not much in it.
But this is my observation. I understand that Taken is a great, entertaining movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what we're talking about with Last House and the themes that people might respond to in this climate.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be the same for Taken. The kind
I think so.
Revenge, vigilantism, fighting back, you know. That's my take.
No, it's just it's a good take. I mean, remember, we had this almost 2 years ago with The Brave One and Death Sentence. So it's a very popular theme at the box office.
Yeah, yeah. Aaron, why don't you call in, man, before we close out the show and tell us what you have upcoming on your programming. I think he just got an interview with Bogdanovich. He just nabbed that on Friday. It's very interesting. These things come in cycles. He's interviewing Friedkin and Bogdanovich within a week or two of
that's
each other.
That's incredible. That's wonderful.
Two of the most arrogant
people
on the planet.
That's a nice euphemism for it, sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Anything else come out this weekend that I'm not aware of? I mean,
that's
anything.
That's the only thing that really came out. That's the only thing. That's the only thing out there right now. I mean, I think with this coming weekend with Race to Witch Mountain, Last House on Left, we finally have the spring movie season coming into full gear finally. So.
Yeah, I just April looks like a wasteland. It really does.
Do you think that? You don't think like
yes.
I mean, I know there's a lot of popcorn. There's a lot of popcorn stuff that you don't respond to, but I think there's like the Fast and Furious looks like it could be fun. Observer Report looks like it could be very funny. And I know. I mean, aren't we going to have the whole cast and crew of 17 again on?
No.
Okay, that was a joke. Obviously, that fell flat. Matthew Perry, yeah, as a young man, he looked like Zac Efron. I mean,
what I'm talking about is when I look through the release schedule, I'm looking for interview requests to send in. Who do I want to talk to from any of these movies? No one. That's not to say if somebody comes through and says, hey, interview this person from this movie, I'm going
to
say no.
I'll be very honest. If Seth Rogen wanted to talk to us and Anna Faris about Observe and Report,
I'd jump
on that immediately. They're just
I would too.
Maybe, I know you would, but I mean, that would be those would be funny interviews. And I'd be very curious to hear what Paul Walker and Vin Diesel and all them have to say working together again.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm going to talk to the amazing Kreskin next week, I'm for certain going to talk to Seth Rogen. Isn't that amazing?
It is.
Get an email out of nowhere. You want to interview Kreskin? Sure. I never thought I'd have that opportunity.
It's going to be a good one. Does Aaron know that he's supposed to call in? Or
yeah, he's on the line. I was just enjoying small talk with you, Jerry.
I know. But we got to have Aaron on because he's the man of the hour.
A rare moment we can spend time together, just the two of us. I've lit candles here to celebrate.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, there you go.
I need a drink.
Aaron, buddy, you're on the line.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey, what's up, man? Welcome back.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Don't sound so excited about being on.
Yeah, really, man.
I've been
your enthusiasm is killing me.
I've been enjoying a lazy Sunday. I've been doing some prep for my Jenny Lamette interview. So I was watching Rachel getting married.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So
Tuesday night?
No. Well, that is going to be a pre-recorded interview on Friday the 13th to air on the 17th.
Okay. Tuesday is Howard the Duck.
Yeah, Tuesday night, Howard the Duck, people. Willard Height and Gloria Katz, the husband and wife team behind Howard the Duck, will be on Back by Midnight, 9 p.m.
Cool.
Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Talk about all of that.
Aaron said he was doing research for the Howard the Duck show, and I said, What are you reading about the Nuremberg or something?
Well, it was
reading
on,
about the Hindenburg. Oh my God!
Well, you know, Universal.
Hindenburg. That's right. That's right.
Universal won't send me any product of any kind for advance. Well, occasionally they will, but for the most part they have shunned me. But I got around that because Howard the Duck, as everyone knows, is on Hulu. So yeah, so it's all free.
Wow, that's the way to see that film, really.
Yeah. So I saw Howard the Duck, did some doing some research on Willard Hike and Gloria Katz, and as I've stated to people, I go, you know, the analogy I make is that the they say the test of a relationship early on is to take a cross-country trip with your significant other. And I think in Hollywood, the test of a good partnership, a creative partnership, is not the hits, but when you have that first big, you know, commercial, critical disappointment.
Right. I think that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it'll be fun. I mean, these people...
So are you going to be doing marriage counseling? Is that what's going on?
That's the thing I'm the impression I'm under, I mean...
No, I think they've done well together. I mean, Howard the Duck is not their, I guess you could say their
shining achievement.
Achievement. But these guys, I mean, they co-wrote together American Graffiti and the best Indiana Jones film, Temple of Doom.
Mm-hmm.
And also they did a really underrated film from 1979 called French Postcards. That's really a good movie. I mean, so they have some good stuff on there. And,
this sounds like this is going to be a really good interview.
Yeah, I will say Radioland Murders, which is wildly uneven, but there's some stuff in there that when it does work, it's really a fun period fart.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're responsible for that also. So, yeah, so they will, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think people are really going to be surprised.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. I must admit, I will be looking forward to that kind of a light evening, considering the past 2 weeks that I had, more or less. So,
I just want you to know that we're going up against you that night. We're doing our tribute to Geely. So
Is that how you're going to finally land Al Pacino's interview?
That may be the only way at this point. That may be the only way.
I will say, you know, for those of you the five of us who saw Geely, Al Pacino and Christopher Walken were the highlights.
I'd say that Christopher Walken is. I read Pacino's response about Geely. The interviewer said, "Did you do it as a favor to Martin Brest?" And he said, "No, not really, kind of." He said, "I got the script and it was 3 days' work and I was off and I thought, you know, I'll try it." And he said, "I don't recommend watching it. I didn't achieve any particular flavor that I wanted to with it." But they asked me back for reshoots, and I said no.
Really?
Yeah. He said it was clear to him that there was going to be some problem with the movie because of the relationship would overshadow the movie itself.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually on Ebert. You know, Ebert didn't like the film either. But I don't think it's the most unwatchable movie ever made.
No, it isn't.
It's fine. It's not fine. I mean, it's just a film. I mean, it's a film that tried something different and it just didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It's a stew that doesn't taste very good, but if you take out the individual ingredients, those taste fine.
Right.
It's like quite a few good ideas just put into this big stew that doesn't work altogether.
Yeah, I mean, so it different director or different, or maybe one or two more rewrites. It might have been something really, really, really special. So,
by the way, all of my analogies involve food.
I've noticed
just
that.
Just want to
when are we going to get a Steak and Shake analogy?
Every time I call Aaron, I'm at the drive-thru of something like a Steak and Shake. I haven't been to Steak and Shake in months, dude.
Yeah. See, he won't go to Steak and Shake anymore because he'll call me.
Yeah.
That's why he's not going. And profits are down in this recession at Steak and Shake.
That's right. They depend upon me.
They do.
I always get extra cheese on my burger.
Yeah.
Okay, so did you see Watchmen today, Aaron?
I did not see Watchmen today. I've been reading about it. I'll probably go in the middle of the week. Because I want to go to the IMAX.
Yeah, that's what I hear is the way to see it. I'm going to try to go in a couple weeks.
I did see they did release the opening credits online that you can now kind of post online on your website, the opening credits to the film. So I watched the opening credit sequence, which is pretty spectacular.
It is. It really is.
We got callers. Do you believe that?
I believe it. I know Jared doesn't, but I believe it.
Let's take a call. Let's take our callers here, starting with 506 area code. 506, you're on the line.
Is it me?
It
yes,
is you.
It is you.
It's Red Hulk again.
Hey, Red Hulk, what's up?
Nothing's really up right now. Well, I'm sorry I called a little bit later than I thought. I had plans, but I told you I'd try to get back on.
Yeah.
I missed a few. And I remember now, before, I know what you were saying before about my inspiration for my name. Well, I just want to say about House on the Left first up. I know that Wes Craven made this movie itself, the original one, right? It seems for now he's been getting a lot of movies he's made remade, like, you know, this is getting remade, Nightmare on Elm Street's getting remade.
Yeah.
Like, I don't get why remakes even need to exist. Like, they got Day of the Earth Stood Still. That sucked compared to the original.
Oh, that sucked horribly.
I know.
It's just really wretchedly bad.
Jerry said something funny today. He said they're remaking so many Wes Craven films, they're probably going to remake Music of the Heart.
I'm waiting for it. It's coming. You know it's coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely.
With Jessica Biel.
Yeah, I see that.
Next thing you know they're going to remake Citizen Kane.
Yeah. But do you find that... Some of them don't bother me as much as others. If I'm not attached to the original, I'm more lenient on it. I think why not?
Yeah, like if you haven't really seen the original film, it might be a little bit better to you. But if you've seen, like for example, with this House on the Left thing, if you've seen the original and how bad this next one might suck, like
yeah,
then you're thinking, who thought this up?
Well, I don't think that the new one will suck. I actually think the new one will be more watchable than the other one. But
I never saw the original. I've never even heard of this movie. Like I have no clue what it's about from the trailer, just like I did with Benjamin Button.
Yeah, yeah.
It might be
more watchable than Benjamin Button, actually. But what's interesting is the some of the sequels don't bother me. One of my favorite horror films is the original Texas Chainsaw. And it didn't bother me that they remade that.
They never really remade it. They more had a prequel than a remake. Like,
well, they had the second one was a prequel, but the first one that they came out with was a remake. And, you know, it looked prettier. And that's what I want, a pretty-looking Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
And, like, with certain movies, like with Halloween as well, like I saw the original before I saw the new one by Rob Zombie.
Right.
I actually thought the newer one was a little bit better. The gore factor. But the second one was way gorier than the first, that's for sure.
Well, that's true, but at the same time, I think that the first one... I mean, the first one is like a boogeyman classic, and I don't know that you can get away with making a movie like that today. You have to amp it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I don't get why they even bother to remake classics. They're good enough.
Yeah.
Like
they always do
in.
That, though. They do that. It's a property. It's a name brand that you can cash in, and that's
they can't think of anything good anymore, so they just rip off other people's ideas.
No, there's a lot of great stuff that you can do. There's tons of great original scripts sitting in vaults and on shelves and producers, but you know it's the sad thing is no one wants to take a chance, and they still have the money to take a chance even in these times. But it's just a sad fact.
Okay, for a second there, I thought Joel in the chat room was criticizing the original Chainsaw.
I know, I thought that too. You know, Joel, you got to make yourself clear. I mean,
yeah. Remember Joel called in and he was when he first fell in love with our show is because we talked about the tracking shot in Chainsaw with the cinematographer. Yeah, yeah. Okay, you're okay. You're off the hook, Joel. Thank you so much,
Joel. We love you.
You're back in our good graces.
Just before I just go here, I just wanted to mention before you asked me. Before how my name came up with Red Hulk. you might not, I know you don't know this, but although I love the Oscars and I was pretty surprised with certain things at the Oscars, like the Slumdog won 8 Oscars, I'm not surprised with that, but I'm also a comic book reader. Like, I love comic books.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Years ago, I had an idea for Red Hulk out there. Like, I came up with the idea beforehand a long, long time ago. And just recently, I actually posted it on a blog a little while back. But it's been deleted now. It's gone. It can't get it back. And I actually asked Marvel if they could look at a different idea I had, not the Red Hulk idea. And they actually took my Red Hulk idea and used it in their comic books today. That pissed me off, so I decided to use it as a username from now on.
Well, that seems to be the ultimate revenge. But what was the Red Hulk idea? Was it...
It was originally a guy like Bruce Banner, kind of. Instead, he got exposed to a little bit more gamma radiation, except he had a little bit more fighting skills than the Hulk. He wouldn't just smash random stuff. He kept his intelligence. He could use guns, nunchucks, if you gave him some, and other weapons.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Hulk with nunchucks. Let's just see that.
Exactly. That's like feeding a whale a Tic Tac. It's...
Holy shit, man.
all right, man. Well, thanks for clearing that up. I appreciate you listening to the show
and
calling in, buddy. Keep in touch, man.
I'll try my best.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye. Red Hulk, ladies and gentlemen.
I thought it was the Red Hulk because the Green Hulk had some spicy food.
True, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was nice. And just a trivia question. Does anyone know what Howard T. Duck's special... fighting skill is?
No, I don't.
Jamie?
Oh.
You have the Japanese import. You don't know?
Wasn't it nunchucks?
No. He was a master of quack fu.
Wow.
You'll get all that and more Tuesday night.
Tuesday night, I'm back by midnight.
That's great. All right, bud. So what's the email? The email. What's the address that they go to on the internet for your show?
Blogtalkradio.com, obviously, /backbymidnight. That's /by-midnight in capital letters on the first letters of those words. Back by midnight.
You know what? That doesn't matter.
Did
you know that?
Did I know that?
If it's not capitalized.
Okay. So just /by-midnight. There you go. And so, yeah,
okay.
So, got that. And as you stated earlier, and obviously I'll be back beforehand, but I did procure an interview with the legendary film historian and friend of the stars, Peter Bogdanovich, for mid-April, because both the director's cut of Last Picture Show and Nickelodeon are coming to DVD.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that should be fascinating. I think we should play a drinking game.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime he mentions Wells, Ford, or what's the other guy that he always
Hitchcock?
Talks about? Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd be drunk in like 5 minutes, I'm pretty sure.
I would think maybe 2 minutes.
Well, see, here's the other drinking game. I'm going to get him to mention Alan Dwan, who I think is underrated.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever talks about Alan Dwan movies.
Yeah.
We all know about Ford, but no one knows about Alan Dwan.
Well, I've been dying for a conversation about that.
Exactly. So that'll be coming up. And other things are coming up. As you know, we're in prelim on a Star Trek show for mid-May.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other things, a lot of big things. Well, and of course, we can talk about this real early. Get this in the chat room, and then people can start emailing us and bombarding us with what we must cover. And obviously we'll take it all in consideration. In mid-June, we're going to do a cross-promotion with our shows and with the House Next Door about the summer of 84.
Yes. Well, we're in discussions.
Yeah, we're in discussions. So
I'm not sold on 84 yet, but you know, if we follow tradition, we should do 84.
Well, Red Dawn, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Gremlins, I mean...
There you go. And don't forget Breaking.
Breaking and a Cloak and Dagger and Star Trek 3. I mean, yeah.
Gary's into this shit. He's into it.
I'm sorry. I'm chewing on plastic for all of those people out there that are I have a nervous.
What kind of plastic? What kind of plastic are you chewing on? Like toy soldiers or something? I mean, what?
I take the wrapper out of off from around my. This is fascinating radio, by the way. Off from around the my Mountain Dew bottle, and I chew on it. I've always got to have something in my.
We can't forget
always,
Ghostbusters.
Well, always got to have something in my mouth. Okay, go ahead.
But I mean, I went through IMDb. I had to make a list to pass along to. Keith Ulick at the house next door,
mm-hmm.
and I mean it's as I stated to Jamie, and he's still not 100% sold on this, but I will get him sold on this. I contend that 1984, that summer, is kind of a very the zeitgeist summer of the 80s when MTV and Hollywood meshed completely. And you can see it just in the film and the editing style. It just got different.
Was that the year of Flashdance?
Well, Flashdance was the year before.
The year before.
And that's
okay.
A little, and you can see it in there. But to me, it's 84 because that's when you get Footloose and Purple Rain. You get the breakdancing movies. You get Beat Street. Even something like Walter Hill, who's an action director, he does a movie like Streets of Fire.
That's that is 84, right? That's 84.
That is summer of 84.
Okay.
So it's all.
Maybe we can bring on Michael Paré.
Hey.
On there.
I want Michael Paré on the show.
Yeah.
I want.
If he's not busy working with Uwe Boll, I think we can get him.
I want Michael Paré on my show. He had the greatest jaw in early 80s action movies, Joe.
Yeah, he could have been on Dick Tracy and not even worn makeup. We have a call here. Hang on. We have a call here. It's an unlisted number. Caller, are you with us?
Hey, it's Joel Valley. What's going on, guys?
Hi, Joel.
Hey, buddy.
I just want to apologize for you guys thinking I criticized Texas Chainsaw. I love that movie.
Joel had to call
it so much.
Defend his name.
I love it so much. I call in to clarify.
Ben, you do. We love you.
You remember,
you're awesome.
Do you remember Summer of 84?
No.
Do you remember the Summer of 84?
No.
No.
Do you want to remember the Summer of 84? We're trying to decide whether or not to do the show.
No. 83 was awesome. No. 83 was awesome.
See,
yeah,
we did that last year,
Did that last year. Now it's 25 years later. So now we're
I don't know. What was 84?
No, but there are some Ghostbusters and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Gremlins, Red Dawn.
Okay, let's do it. Yeah, I'm in.
All right, we got Joel on board, okay?
Last right. Starfighter, Neverending Story, Tightrope, Dreamscape, Firestarter, Friday 13th Part 4.
Wow. Well, you sold me on that last one.
Yeah, I know. We haven't had enough Friday the 13th. But
I'm pushing for 89, though. But I know that's not the 25-year mark. It's not the quarter of a century.
But no, for 20th anniversary, why not? Batman, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, another Star Trek there, Star Trek 5, License to Kill, Lethal Weapon 2. Come on, what's not to love? The Abyss.
Wired. Don't forget Wired, folks, and Eddie and the Cruisers too.
That's the kind of movie.
One thing at a time, boys.
I don't want to cover something. Yeah, Joel, I don't want to cover stuff like... Ghostbusters and stuff like that what is there to cover there? I'd want to cover a movie like Wired. I'd want to cover something that hasn't been explored or talked about ad nauseum.
But I wouldn't want to, I agree with you there, but Wired, I just think it because the book was so fraudulent.
No, the book was real. The movie was fraudulent.
No,
yeah.
The book is a really a bad, I mean, that's why she wrote that book about Belushi a couple of years ago. Because that book was lied a lot. Bob Woodward really dropped the ball with that book. And she wrote, his widow wrote that book a couple of years ago. Very nice coffee table book about Belushi. So
yeah, you can snort coke off of it. But that's terrible. I'm so sorry,
Mike. We could get Michael Chicky Chiklis because that was his big film debut.
Remember what they told him? He'd never work again.
Mm-hmm.
And he proved everyone wrong.
And he just signed on to play Red Hulk. So, I mean, come on.
We're having a field day with it. Folks, we're like this every week, twice a week. So join us twice a week, please.
As Jamie knows, I'm Brown Hulk.
Yeah.
So wait a second. Do you really want to go on record saying that, Aaron?
Yeah, I'm Brown Hulk.
You're Brown? Okay.
I'm proud of that.
What can Brown do for you? Okay,
Joel, buddy, tell me what's going on with your movie.
Yeah.
Oh, the movie, I just got back from the United States, and it'll be my first movie of Mexican and U.S. productions.
Cool.
Kind of teaming up, and we got some boys from Guerrilla Pictures up there in Michigan who are going to come down and film it. We're filming it on two red cameras.
Wow.
Two red cameras? Awesome.
Yeah, I can't wait. We're just finishing up some last minute script things, and then we'll be casting here probably within the next couple months. And I think we're shooting for October, November to start filming. So
I want to be the guy that gets fed grapes by the scantily clad women. Can you cast me as that?
Yeah, you know that's in the sequel, bro.
Oh man,
in the sequel. I'll get you in the sequel though.
Get us both in the sequel.
You're shooting this in Mexico?
Yeah, we are shooting in Mexico, and I'm just working on getting the permits and stuff. And so there's a lot of stuff that's going on behind the scenes, but we're real busy on it, and we are excited. And you guys will be the first to get all the scoops, and hopefully I want to bring you guys down here for a premiere.
Oh,
we missed you on the last one.
We'll broadcast live from there, dude.
Yeah, that's
why the movie geeks down.
Yeah, we love you, man. We love your stuff, and we love your creativity and your passion for this. Here's a trivia question that we'll leave off with, going back to Last House on the Left. Where do you think that film was shot?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not. I've seen it, and I'm not a big fan of it.
I'm talking about the remake.
The remake.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Tells you how much the business has changed. Aaron, you know?
I'm what?
I know exactly where it's at.
All right. Go ahead.
It was shot somewhere in the continental United States.
No, it was not.
Really?
The Last House on the Left was shot in South Africa.
South Africa, really?
Yeah.
Really? It's amazing because they shot Ash to Dust in South Africa, too. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, to look like 30s L.A., right?
And so they, in South Africa, to shoot, dude, I had no idea. Wow.
So
couldn't
it be the last shanty town on the left?
Okay,
but
on that note.
That really tells you how the film business is changing, how we've got to get the tax breaks and everything else going in the States. They're shooting Westerns in Canada. They're shooting, like, Westerns that take place in, like, Montana. They're going up to Alberta.
They shot Cold Mountain in Czechoslovakia?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
same thing with Costner's movie.
It's too expensive in the States.
You're right.
It's too expensive.
They shot
in a hospital for $30 a day. A hospital permit to shoot in hospitals, $30 a day. You can't beat that.
Yeah.
No, you really can't.
Yeah. It's the only time you'll only spend $30 at a hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Joel, my friend. Thank you so much, buddy, for calling in and listening in. We love you, man.
Oh, you guys are doing great. We'll see you.
Thank you.
Thank
you very much. We appreciate it.
Bye-bye, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we had callers tonight and everything. I'm just so sad we didn't have Twilight DVDs to give away.
No. They make great coasters.
Oh, so how do we feel about Dakota being in the new Twilight movie? We don't feel nothing.
I've never been so bored in my life, okay? So I don't...
But I will say this for Dakota Fanning, and if she commits, as she always says she does to every role, I will be the first in line for the Runaways movie.
Right. Oh yeah, well that means a lot more to me than a Twilight sequel. I mean,
when I read that, I thought that is either going to be the greatest thing ever or the worst thing ever. Either way, I'll be the first one in line to see that.
Didn't Drew Barrymore just sign on to direct the third Twilight movie?
I think so.
She did, and which is a good thing. Actually, the first Twilight movie is not a bad film. It is actually well made. The best, and the reason, and unfortunately, I don't know why they did it, and I think it's unfortunate by not bringing back Catherine Hardwicke to the second one. I don't expect much from the second one, and the fact that the second one will be directed by a male director, I find unfortunate. I do think this would be they should be using this series as a showcase for women directors.
Yeah.
And Catherine Hardwicke is a great, great female director. I would love to see Kathryn Bigelow do one of these.
Yeah. Jerry wants to know if you're on crack, Eric.
Yeah, dude. The first one was. I know we're not. I know I'm not the target audience for the first for the Twilight movies. But I was. I've never been that bored in my life.
I'm not the target audience for that either. But.
But come on, dude. Aaron, I know you're a nice guy. I know you want to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. But come on, that movie was boring. Come on, brother. You know.
It was not boring. I thought it had a.
Please tell me that Stephanie Meyer is sending you a check after the show at least.
Whether you like the film or not, that was a true original vision by Catherine Hardwicke, and it did have a unique teenage romanticism that is very that has not been seen in movies in a while, and also you gotta love the vampire baseball. That was badass.
Dude, I hope I don't know what they're paying you. I hope it's a lot. My heart goes out to you. I hope they're paying you a lot because I've never heard anyone say that.
Well, Aaron, you also thought that Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was a great statement on the modern nuclear family, right?
Dude, aren't they? Are they? Please tell me they're boosting your 401k.
If there's a real vision and there's something, you know, there's some kind of momentum in the story. I will be engaged at some level. I was more bored with, Funny Games by Michael Haneke.
I'm not going to hear no argument from me there. But I mean, my God, dude, I just hope that you are getting reimbursed somehow. God bless you.
I say this. I'm not saying Twilight was one of the best films of the year, or it's even a terrific movie. But on its own modest terms, just like the books. Their own modest terms, it does what it set out to do quite well. And I think there's been a lot of, I think the backlash, if you will, on the book series and this movie, and particularly in the upcoming movie, I think some of it, the hostility doesn't match what they're being hostile to. There's a disconnect there.
Well,
I hope Eli Roth will direct the fourth and final one.
Thank you, Aaron Armand White. Because he liked Twilight a bunch more than he liked Let the Right One In. That was his Better Than list.
Well, and Let the Right One In is a better film.
God, it's not fair to compare the two. God, I'm going to throw up. I'm going
to
really just throw up.
Well, it's not
right
fair
now.
To compare the two. Armand White compared the two, and he was...
Wait. We haven't even talked about this yet. Armand White, did anyone read the profile of him in New York Magazine a couple
yes,
weeks ago?
Yes.
It was a fluff piece.
I really wanted to get Glenn Kenny's reaction to that.
If you look closer and read between the lines, towards the end there, Mark Jacobson is, and I think he should have done a little more, is actually kind of mocking Armand White.
Oh, totally.
But I think it's a little too subtle. I mean, there's still that profile piece to be, that not so much be confrontational with Armand, but actually ask him the questions that I think a lot of people want to ask him point blank. Put his speech up. I might be doing that. So who knows?
I really enjoyed this fight, that conversation.
I just can't. I mean, I just really hope. I mean, I hope. I mean, I would say it too if they could reimburse my 401k. Hell yeah. I mean, maybe we should end the show. I don't know.
All right, Aaron. Thanks, buddy,
Aaron,
for calling.
Always
in.
A pleasure. Good luck with the future shows. They sound really fascinating.
Oh yeah.
And Jerry, thank you for tuning. Thank you for co-hosting tonight with me.
No problem. Anytime.
All right, David Hess tomorrow night on
Horror Yearbook Radio. It should be a blast.
All right, buddy.
All right.
We'll see you guys next
Wednesday.
This Wednesday, we have a couple of book authors about film, and I'll tell you more about it in the blog postings. But join us Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. I enjoyed it, everybody. Thanks so much.
All right. Good night. Bye bye.